This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, report was released last Monday on the 28th of February and assessed the impacts of climate change, looking at ecosystems, biodiversity, and human communities at global and regional levels. So the report has been described as a dire warning about the consequences of inaction and also, and I'm quoting here, an atlas of human suffering. So today on the show, I'm going to discuss some key messages and also some contentious issues that were raised in the report with Meenakshi Raman, the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia, and she's also the head of programs at the Third World Network. Welcome, Meena. How are you today?
I'm fine, Juliet. Always happy to talk to you.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. So we're going to dissect this really robust report that's just come out. The description that I gave just now, you know, Atlas of Human Suffering, of course, that was what the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the report, right? He said it's also a damning indictment of failed climate leadership. So we're going to get to that. But Meena, maybe we can just sort of establish what IPCC reports are. So we do know that it was established 34 years ago to provide of like actionable information on climate change for decision makers, and also that these IPCC reports are the result of a unique collaboration of scientific expertise, but also political consensus, right? Can you remind us why all of this is so important?
Yeah, climate change is, many years ago when it was an issue, there were, of course, people who were denying the climate science, particularly, you know, there were fossil fuel corporations who were actually putting out news that it is really, it's not, climate change is not due to global warming and greenhouse effect and so on. So it was, has been quite controversial. But the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was established basically to guide policymakers and the intergovernmental negotiations on climate change. So the UN Convention, Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Paris Agreement, the Kyoto Protocol, all of these very important multilateral agreements on climate change were in large part influenced actually by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, because the international community relies on them for decisions and policies and so on.
Mm-hmm. And there's another part of it, right, which is the summary for policymakers. And that's really quite important, isn't it?
Yes, actually, the what happens is that every 5 years, the Intergovernmental Panel, they've got their various working groups. This is Working Group 2 on Impacts, Adaptation, and Vulnerability. So what happens is that they go through peer-reviewed materials, scientific materials, cull them all together, and then they put together an underlying assessment, which is called the Underlying Technical Assessment. From that, which is about 1,000 over pages and so on, from that, there is a summary for policymakers which is drawn up. And that's negotiated line by line with the governments. So the governments are not involved in the underlying report, but they are involved in the negotiations of the summary for policymakers, because it actually presents the summary of what's in the underlying report to actually guide policymakers and make it, you know, less with the headline messages and so on, so that governments understand.
Mm-hmm. Actually understand the science behind all of it, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, all right. So this report, which is called the IPCC 6th Assessment Report, Impacts, Adaptation and Vulnerability. So now this is the second of three installments, am I correct? And that will comprise the full report, which is expected later this year. We know that the first, you kindly explained the first one to us also last year, and that focused on how anthropogenic greenhouse gases are responsible for widespread planetary damage. But this report zooms in on causes, impacts and possible solutions to climate change, right? What would you say is new about this particular adaptation report?
Yeah, see, as you know, that when we in the climate change discourse, we talk about mitigation, which is emissions reductions, and we talk about adaptation, the point about to actually adapt to the impacts because it's already happening. Mm. So this is the impact report. When you talk about mitigation, that's the next report which is coming, the emission reductions report, which is expected to be hugely controversial because it deals with who's responsible for much of the emissions and how do you go about that and so on. But this particular one is actually very critical now, because for the longest time, adaptation has always been seen as a sidelined topic. it's secondary to emission reductions or mitigation. So what's important about this report is that it's actually very frightening. And what it's actually showing is that the climate impacts are already more widespread and severe than expected. The last assessment was 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this assessment report has been compiling all that has happened over the last 5 years. And it's actually very frightening. Because what the scientists are saying is that when we look at the droughts, we look at the forest fires, we look at the devastating floods, we look at the storms, what they say, and this is what the report is so important for, is that it's worse than what they had expected. Mm. And so this is really why this report is very, very critical. So one of the findings, for instance, you know, the droughts, the extreme heat, the record floods already threaten food security and livelihoods for millions of people. And devastating floods and storms have forced more than 20 million people from their homes each year. This is quite a big number.
Yeah.
And crop productivity, many parts of the world have affected by crop productivity. And half the global population already facing water insecurity, at least 1 month per year in terms of water insecurity. We feel that already in this country.
We do.
Even in the floods, as you know. And then what is really frightening is that climate change is already harming species and whole ecosystems. Animals such as, they talk about the golden toad, some rodents are now already extinct due to the warming world. And other animals such as flying fox, seabirds and corals are experiencing mass die-offs. They are dying. And thousands have already moved to higher elevations and altitudes. So you see, we don't see this happening, but this report brings it together to show that the impacts are really real and they are worse, much, much worse than we have expected.
Okay. All right. And again, this is like backed by science. You know, I think there's 270 authors across 67 countries are contributing to this, isn't it? And it was quite unambiguous what they said. Human-caused climate change is accelerating at a pace that requires immediate action.
Yes, yes, that's a warning they have always been issuing, but seems like it's not falling. It's falling on deaf ears. Not enough people are hearing the warning signs. Also, what it does say is that we are locked into even worse impacts from climate change in the near term. So what this is, you know, the issue about not acting earlier. Mm. Even if the world rapidly decarbonizes, greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere and the current emission trends will make some very significant climate impacts unavoidable through to 2040. So even if we stopped all emissions today, we have so much of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that the impacts will continue and go through till 2030. And the IPCC estimates that in the next decade alone, climate change will drive 32 to 132 million people more people, 132 to 132 million more people into extreme poverty. And it all that we have talked about in terms of the storms, the floods, the food insecurity, the water crisis, all this will exacerbate much, much more. Mm. So you can see that that we are already locked in into even worse climate impacts in the near term. Maybe another key message, which is important, the risks will escalate quickly with higher temperatures, often causing irreversible impacts on climate change. So what they are saying is that, yes, we need to do something now. We need to know it urgently. There are problems already in the near term, but we have to act in any case. And they say that every tenth of a degree of additional warming will escalate threats to people, species, and ecosystems. Now, that's absolutely frightening. So this, even the limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees from pre-industrial era, the target that was in the Paris Agreement, is not safe at all. So with just 1.5 degrees of global warming, many glaciers around the world will either disappear completely or lose most of their mass. And an additional 350 million people will experience water scarcity by 2030. and as much as 14% of terrestrial species, land-based species, will face high rates of extinction. So this is really, really very concerning. And maybe the final point that I want to stress is that while adaptation is crucial and it's feasible and it has to be done, and there's a lot of stress in this report about ecosystem-based adaptation. Mm. And they're talking about, you know, not some adaptation, which is like maladaptation. For instance, seawalls. Sometimes these seawalls, when we build, they are concrete structures and they lock in, and they may not be the best response to climate change. And in fact, what they actually call for is ecosystem-based adaptation. And many of us have been talking about it, like mangroves, our coastal ecosystem, so important. So the more that they are rooted in biodiversity and nature, ecosystem-based approaches, then they are much more flexible rather than hardwiring of, you know, certain like seawalls that are bricks and concrete. So after you have done that, you actually cause even more problems. And so they also say that some impacts of climate change are already too severe to adapt to. Yeah. This is frightening. Although we are all stressing, in terms of adaptation, they're actually saying that we are already in the world of losses and damages. That means you can't adapt anymore. So it actually says that with the 1.1 degree C of global warming, the world is already experiencing and much impacts, and which are where the people, vulnerable people and ecosystems are beginning to reach the limits of what they can adapt to. So in some regions, these limits are soft, meaning, you know, they are what you call it, some measures that can exist. Mm-hmm. And in other cases, they're actually hard limits to adaptation, where they say that the climate impacts are so severe that no existing adaptation measures can effectively prevent losses and damages. And for instance, some coastal communities in the tropics have lost entire coral reef ecosystems that once helped sustain their food security and livelihoods. And others have had to abandon low-lying neighborhoods and cultural sites as sea levels rise. So you can see that the devastation is going to be much, much more, especially for communities who are most vulnerable. And the losses and damages will only increase as global temperatures rise. Mm-hmm. So this is very important to recognize that adaptation already is reaching its limits.
Reaching its limits, and, you know, as you said, sometimes, I mean, it might perhaps be too late in some circumstances, isn't it?
Exactly. Yes. Okay.
And it's terrifying because, you know, the dates that you gave were, you know, in the near future, in the next 8 years or so. You know, it's not some distant future, you know, some sort of like apocalyptic future. It's coming very, very soon in our lifetime.
Exactly. And this is why, remember when we talked about net zero by 2050, net zero by 2020 is too little, too late. We've stressed that over and over again. Many groups have stressed that. You can't wait for 2050. You're talking about in the next decade, in this decade itself. This is a critical decade to act.
And as you pointed out, Mina, you know, the scientists have been saying this for years and years, and it's only now that, you know, you see corporations sort of cottoning on to net zero or sort of like leeching onto that and using that as a way to, yeah, justify what they're doing as like that is their goal. But it's perhaps too late, right, as this report is saying as well.
Yes. What it basically is saying is that you really can't waste any more time.
Yeah.
And the first working group report on physical sciences was already saying it. Because in terms of what's, the carbon emissions, the trend, if we continue, we will cross 1.5 very soon in this decade, within the next 10 to 12 years already. So there's not much time left for us to really act urgently. But in any event, even if we decarbonize, this is the importance. Adaptation is key. Addressing loss and damage is key. Mm-hmm. And these are two important pillars of the Paris Agreement. And it's not just about emission reductions or mitigation.
Okay. And we're going to go for a quick break, Mina, but when we come back, I want to talk about some of the issues that arose, you know, during the making of this report, right? And some contentious things came up. I'm speaking today to Meenakshi Raman. She's the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia. She's the head of programs at Third World Network. We're discussing the IPCC report 2022, which was just released last week. We'll have more after this quick break. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me today is Meenakshi Raman. She's the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia. She's the head of programs at the Third World Network. And we are, Meena's helping us to dissect the IPCC's sixth assessment report, Impacts, Adaptation and Vulnerability. I guess the bottom line is, you know, we're already past the point of no return. We really, really need to act today. But I want to talk a little bit more about this report, Meena. I was reading some of the Working Group 2's most sobering findings were actually diluted or deleted from the final summary for policymakers, which you talked to us about earlier, by some state parties. And we know, of course, as you said, that the summary was negotiated line by line among governments and authors of the report. And the summary for policymakers is derived from the underlying technical reports, right, which are prepared by the IPCC scientists. I was also reading, and you kindly shared some articles from Third World Network, which reports that several contentious issues arose during the approval session. Am I correct? And these included things like references to losses and damages and nature-based solutions and whether these terms should be included at all in the summary for policymakers. What happened here?
Well, you see, because it's a very important report and given the significance of this report to the negotiations, we already saw losses and damages or loss and damage in the Paris Agreement as it is described.
Yeah.
Already a big issue last year, if you remember in Glasgow,
yes.
We had talked about it. The United States in particular did not want to associate any finance with loss and damage. So they did not agree to a facility for climate finance related to loss and damage. So given that now that we are moving to the next COP, which is COP27 in Egypt, which will take place in November in Sharm el-Sheikh, this report, the summary for policymakers, will be very important. It will be relied on by many governments to make their case. Now, the developing countries, of course, were saying, look, the science is very clear, losses and damage. The term used in the report is losses and damages.
Okay.
In the Paris Agreement, it's loss and damage. But, you know, so was this issue about, is it the same thing? Is it not the same thing? But never mind. The point is that the United States actually tried to undermine. They did not want the term losses and damages. They said that we are going to be having, you know, they were worried about what will happen at COP27.
Right.
They said that, you know, this report is important and it's very political. So why do we have losses? We shouldn't have losses and damage here. But the developing countries fought back. You had countries like India, St. Kitts and Nevis, the small islands, many of the small islands, and they all got together. And they said, no, you can't do this. It is in the underlying report. The science is already telling us with all the literature that has been peer reviewed that losses and damages is happening. So you can't ignore that. So they fought back very hard. And despite the attempts by the United States to dilute a lot, they wanted to replace losses and damages with impacts. It's not the same thing. Losses and damages is losses and damages. So what will happen is that, what happened there was that this fight that happened, and that, like I said, in some places the US did dilute some aspects of it, but in other places they were retained. So this fight will continue, but it's very important for developing countries they have that fight, and that it is recognized that losses and damages from the science of it is something that you have to recognize, because we have reached in some cases the limits of adaptation. So, you know, this is particularly stark. This is my own way of explaining, like you have tropical cyclones which happen. They come and wipe out. So no matter what adaptation you do, they wipe out entire communities. Like, you know, you see our neighbor in Philippines and even our own floods.
Yeah.
Massive, intense floods happen and it just wipes out everything that, you know, your homes, your property, your land, your agriculture, everything is underwater. So you will suffer loss and damage. So that's why it's very critical in the negotiations. And so that's why the United States had this fight, and luckily they did not succeed. The second thing that was important was nature-based solutions, because this, as I have explained before, until recently, and I'll explain that, during the IPCC Working Group 2 discussions on the summary for policymakers, there was no multilaterally agreed definition of what is nature-based solutions.
Uh-huh.
So anybody can interpret it any way they want. And a number of developing countries were very worried that if you introduce this term, it will bring in issues like, you know, carbon markets, with carbon offsets, you know, like that carbon, very controversial Sabah project, where forests are seen as carbon credits for sequestering or removing carbon from the atmosphere. Is that nature-based solution? So this was why it was very contentious, because it was not agreed to. But after the IPCC report, after the IPCC report was approved in the United Nations Environment Assembly just about last week, there was a definition agreed in terms of what is nature-based solutions. So that conundrum of what is nature-based solutions is now resolved. So there is a very long paragraph in the UN Environment Assembly where I think you had a session, you did have my colleague Mage Sangralingam talk about the UNEA 5.0, which was going on.
Yes.
So the NBS issue or nature-based solutions issue was quite an important topic. So that has been resolved. But what's important is still that the in this definition and so on, the approaches will continue to be contentious. What approaches are appropriate in terms of adaptation? Because the term ecosystem-based adaptation is well-known, well-defined in the Convention on Biological Diversity, and that convention is also meeting. There is a COP that will take place, which was postponed from last year, supposed to be hosted by China in Kunming. It will take place this year.
That's right.
So that's also where nature-based solutions will become very important. And so many processes are dealing with this. The final thing I want to say is, which the US really tried to do, which was really shocking, and well, unexpected, but so if I'm shocked, it shouldn't be unexpected, right? But still, the gall to come and say that, you know, in adaptation finance, they did not want the numbers in it on adaptation finance, which was in the underlying report, to be reflected in the summary for policymakers. So you will not see any numbers on finance, although in the underlying assessment, what you will see is that there is a gap between current adaptation levels and those that the needs, you know. So you want to respond to adaptation. Developing countries do need climate finance, and the financial support is key. So the IPCC estimates that adaptation needs will reach $127 billion and $295 billion per year for developing countries alone by 2030 and 2050 respectively, which means 127 billion by 2030 and 295 billion per year by 2050.
Okay.
So this is quite significant. And at the moment, this is recognized in the summary for policymakers, not the numbers I said earlier.
Right.
And at the moment, adaptation accounts for just 4 to 8% of tracked climate finance. That means climate finance, which has been tracked, which total $579 billion in 2017 to 18. Even this number of $579 billion is always contested, because what is that number? Is it loans? Is it guarantees? Is it grants? You know, that's a huge debate. But the point is, these numbers don't appear. But the 4 to 8% of, or only 4 to 8% is adaptation is reflected. So you can see how difficult it was to have adaptation finance as a very important issue. Now, this links us back again to Glasgow, and it connects us to Sharm el-Sheikh for COP27. In Glasgow, there was a big fight about climate finance in general, loss and damage finance, as I had explained, but also adaptation finance. Now, developing countries have constantly said that's not enough money from developed countries, because this is an obligation. Many don't understand this. It's an obligation of developed countries to contribute to climate finance, not developing countries. Developing countries do not need to contribute a single cent to climate finance internationally. Mm-hmm. If they want to, they can do it voluntarily, but it's not an obligation. This is due to the understanding that historical emissions, past emissions, have been very key. And much of it is the responsibility of the developed world who actually caused the emissions. So because of that responsibility, climate finance is from developed to developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
So Sharm el-Sheikh is going to be very important, because in Glasgow, all that was in the decision was that government, the developed countries, promise to double finance of for adaptation. This is insignificant. There's no, just doubling from what it is today is quite insignificant. Mm-hmm. And we already know about this 100 billion per year by 2020 that was pledged in Copenhagen and then Cancun, which we know is not met. It's far away from being met. Now, this is a pre-2020 pledge. And we are talking from the Paris Agreement about post-2025 pledge. So, this 100 billion, people always get confused. They think 100 billion is for under the Paris Agreement. It's not. That was before Paris is this 100 billion. Post-Paris, they're supposed to negotiate a new goal on finance. So adaptation finance is absolutely key. And the report, IPCC report, clearly shows how insignificant it has been. So this is why it became so controversial. And the United States and other developed countries actually tried to downplay that. Downplay the numbers and did not want those numbers to appear in the summary for policymakers. But we know that the developing country negotiators, they can rely. It doesn't mean that you just focus on the SPM, the summary for policymakers. You can also look at the underlying reports and you can extract those numbers and use that in the negotiating fight. So this is likely to happen in Sharm el-Sheikh.
Okay. So it's sort of like wanting to not take account for, or is sort of pushing off the accountability pretty much. I mean, to just put it in very, very basic terms.
Yes, basically. I think what the developed world, because it's there, they have to do this. They don't want any numbers defined.
Right.
They say that this is political, our parliaments, our budgets, we have to decide. Nobody can tell us what the amount is. But it's so important to be needs-based. Mm. Not just some magic wand that was waved in Copenhagen, plucked out of a hat, you have a magic number of 100 billion. Whether it was enough, we know it's far from adequate, barely far from adequate, and that's not enough. So that's why it's so critical to have a needs-based assessment, which actually even the IPCC was looking at in terms of what's been peer-reviewed so far. So that's really key. The other thing that I just want to also say for listeners, Sharm el-Sheikh is not going to be easy. We are already hearing from negotiators that the developed world does not want adaptation to feature big in Sharm el-Sheikh. So can you believe it? They want to underplay and undermine and not recognize the importance of adaptation and losses and damages despite this new working group report. So it's going to be hugely contentious. And so, so I think that the developed world has really needs to unite strongly and join forces to prevent any kind of setback. We do need to advance on the adaptation agenda and on the losses and damage agenda, and the IPCC report is very key for this.
Can I just ask you, Mina, if they don't want to have adaptation, or they don't want to focus on adaptation and losses and damages, what are they pushing for actually then?
All they are interested in talking about is they want to talk about mitigation, emissions reductions.
Okay.
And this is what for them is most important. We agree that emissions reductions are important. But as I had explained before, that this whole net zero and so on is something that was hugely contentious there in Glasgow. Mm. And there is an important process which will take place next year. It's called the global stocktake under the Paris Agreement.
Okay.
Because parties agreed that you need to take a stocktake from time to time in terms of how the global community has responded to climate change.
Okay.
And it's not just about whether we are within are we able to limit temperature rise? So it's not just about mitigation. It's also about adaptation. It's also about loss and damage. It's also about finance, technology transfer, and capacity building. So this is why developing countries have called this a comprehensive global stocktake. Because when the developed world talks only about emissions reductions without the money, then they begin to de-link the need for developing countries to actually do that transition with the resources. Some countries may be able to afford it, but as we had pointed out before, with the COVID pandemic and the economic crisis and even governments using whatever budgets to do the national responses, climate change and the responding to climate change and the sustainable development goals is really, for a lot of countries, off the chart because they are getting into more and more debts now. So climate finance is absolutely critical. So this is why the developed world, when they talk about mitigation and emissions reductions without the link to finance, it's a no-go for many developing countries. And this is why Egypt is going to be so important.
Okay. All right. We're just going to go for one more quick break, Mina, and then we'll come back and just talk about, you know, the importance that has been placed on addressing social inequities in climate vulnerabilities and responses. I'm speaking today to Meenakshi Raman. She's the president of Sahaba Alam Malaysia. She's the head of programs at Third World Network. We are dissecting the IPCC's sixth assessment report, Impacts, Adaptation and Vulnerability. We'll have more after this quick break. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Today on the show, we are dissecting the sixth assessment report by the IPCC, Impacts, Adaptation and Vulnerability. Helping me to do that is Meenakshi Raman. She's the president of Sahaba Alam Malaysia. She's also the head of programs at the Third World Network. And Mina, you know, before the break, you were sort of explaining some of the contentious issues that were, that happened, you know, during the negotiation process, right? For the summary for policymakers. There was one other thing that I came across, which I didn't quite understand. And this was about climate responses and adaptation, right? And it was something to do with solar. What is the phrase I'm looking for?
Solar radiation modification.
Solar radiation modification. And that was hugely contested as well, right? During the negotiations. Can you tell me what that was about?
Yes, actually, more of it will be coming in the next report. Because what's happening is that, you know, instead of really doing the kind of real transformative solutions to the way to go low carbon in the way our production systems are and in the way we consume, that we really need to transform dramatically. Instead of doing that, you know, the rich having to, particularly the rich having to reshape their lifestyles and not go on this huge binge, you know, and destroying this world. I think some of these governments, particularly in the United States, they are pushing what's called solar radiation modification. Techno fixes. And one of those techno fixes is SRM, is called solar radiation modification, where you it's like a new, it's geoengineering.
Right.
That means you're engineering geologically, meaning some of it is like pushing pellets into the atmosphere or putting ocean fertilization, doing something in the oceans, which will absorb the carbon. Now, these are very dangerous because they have not been assessed. They are like new science fiction, and the impacts will be worse than the climate response itself.
Gosh.
So this is what the IPCC was warning in the underlying report, but what the United States came in and said was that it was very unbalanced. They said that the authors, when they put the summary for policymakers in relation to solar radiation modification, were giving the negative effects. They weren't saying, weren't balancing it.
Okay.
So they were opposed to this. So after a big fight and so on, the authors were insisted that you can't simply invent something which is not there. And so they did, there was a paragraph there which to somewhat allay the fears of the US to say that there is need for more balanced treatment, but there's also a lot of caveats in terms of solar radiation modification. Now, this is a fight which will happen also in the working group 3, mm-hmm. because it's about emission reductions and how do we do emission reductions. So these new mumbo jumbo technologies will always be there. Even carbon capture and storage, even our own country, you know, we've heard about Petronas going into carbon capture and storage, which is very, very expensive. And it's also quite controversial. So these are quick fixes. I mean, it's not really quick, but it's actually dangerous fixes that could actually take us the wrong way. So that I wanted to explain that as a major controversy as well.
Yeah, I think it was described as geoengineering gambles, right? And it's just
exactly.
Yeah, and it's just what the report is saying, that we need permanent impacts requires deep emission cuts, including through rapid phase out of fossil fuel production and combustion.
Exactly.
And this is
exactly.
just a way of pushing.
Exactly. Yep. And, you know, most likely it's all the fossil fuel companies who are promoting this so that so that they continue to do what they can do. While, you know, with the, and then, you know, you have all these massive technologies which they claim will solve the problem and they don't have to do anything. Mm. So this is really the problem.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, there's going to be more fights on that. So I will be asking you about that as well. There was one other thing about this IPCC Working Group 2 report, right? And that includes a pronounced focus on the importance of addressing social inequities in climate vulnerabilities and responses. Why is this important?
I think what the assessment report also showed, that the climate impacts are received disproportionately. Those who are poorer will suffer worse than those who are well off. For instance, let's take one simple example that we all will know. As the climate gets warmer, now it's easy for rich people to put in two air conditioners or three air conditioners, or go and live in some other part of the world where they will have more cooler climates. Mm-hmm. This is not an option for the poor. They have no choice. Even here, can you imagine? Even in our high-rise buildings, flats, low-cost flats and so on. As the temperature goes up, the building is also not built in a climate-resilient way. So where are they going to go afford more air conditioners and more air conditioners? It's not going to be possible. So this is one of the, I'm just giving you an illustration of what it means, the disproportionate impact. Mm-hmm. Or coastal communities, fishing communities, for instance, who live along the coastal areas in many parts of our country as well, who depend on fish resources. And here you have, cyclones and tropical storms and violent extreme weather. Mm-hmm. And they can't go out and fish. But worse than that, their coastal ecosystem is damaged. So you do find that, so the poor will become even poorer. So they are less resilient. They're not able to move anywhere. They don't have other options. Similarly, the IPCC also talks about, indigenous peoples who rely on ecosystems, you know, the forest and the natural resources around them. And if the weather changes, the climate impacts actually cause more and more stress in the ecosystem, these communities also will have problems in terms of livelihoods and meeting their water resources and all their other human needs. So this is what we say, that in the IPCC recognizes in what's called the climate resilient development.
Okay.
You need climate resilient development. And one of the controversies here was whether you need to acknowledge the role of past emissions. India actually said, and they were supported by China and other countries in South Africa and so on. So you need to acknowledge past emissions. You cannot simply look at current and future emissions and say that, it's no problem. Because what the IPCC is saying is that climate resilient development is the way we need to do planning for the future. Then, not actually future, now.
No, yeah.
Every pathway, every development, every plan that you do, every house that you build, every building that you put up, it needs to be climate resilient. And in this country, unfortunately, we are not paying enough attention. We are only just beginning to wake up to adaptation, let alone, being aware of loss and damage. So we need to have climate resilient development, a very important finding of the IPCC message. And so the role of past emissions is important. At the same time, what's critical is that we have to make sure that for climate resilient development, there are preconditions, that poverty eradication is key because the most vulnerable are those who are poor. So the poor have to be most, it's not going and giving out handouts. That will not solve. That is what sickens me to the stomach, when we saw our flood happen. The only response that we see happening most of the time, handouts. That's where whether the politician or the corporation goes and, takes a big check and give people. That's not what this is about. We need to prevent that kind of disaster from happening over and over again. So for climate resilient development, the precondition is to address the inequities, enable the poor and the vulnerable to be able to cope, to make them climate resilient. And that's what's important. And I think it's such an important concept and understanding that needs to permeate through every whether in planning, whether, you know, with the architects, with the engineers, with the, you know, related to the entire ecosystem, whether it's your forest, whether your coast, whether it's your oceans. So I think there's a lot that we have to understand in terms of climate resilient development, and addressing poverty and then redressing that is really very key. It is linked to the Sustainable Development Goals, the meeting of the Sustainable Development Goals.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, you see the corporations, you see, you know, even developers and all using those phrases, isn't it, you know, Sustainable Development Goals, but, you know, just sort of picking on the catchphrases, I suppose, and just using what's catchy and what's, you know, will make them, put them in a good light, but not actually doing the correct thing or the right thing in adaptation, in mitigating all these issues. So that's the problem that we're facing.
Exactly. So even when we do environmental impact assessments now, you know, because that's one of the things that we take part in, looking at all these projects and one of the few avenues that we have in terms of public participation. And there is not much emphasis on climate resilient development. Mm. Is this a climate resilient development? And it's, in some cases, in one case, and this is the Penang South reclamation case, the reclamation that of the three islands was even said to be a climate response. It was mind-boggling. How that reclamation project is seen as the climate response. I mean, it's as you say, you know, all the co-option of these important concepts that, you know, turned around the head to justify these projects, when we all know that reclamation is going to cause more problems rather than, it's not climate resilient development by no means. And I'd like to have a debate with anyone who claims that it is climate resilient development.
Oh, I should get on that then, Mina. That's the next one that I have to get you on for. I'm afraid we're running out of time, Mina. But, you know, any last message you'd like to leave us with, you know, especially, you know, for people who just think this is some report that doesn't affect them whatsoever, you know, it's something that the policymakers and the scientists need to fight about. But why is it important for all of us?
This is about life and death. I mean, we are already facing it here. I know, and we have stressed this over and over again. And the impacts are going to get much worse. So your floods are going to get much worse. Your water crisis is going to get much worse. Your drought is going to get much worse. Your heat is going to, you're going to get more hot, and you're not going to be able, you know, ordinary living is going to be even worse. Now we are coping with the pandemic, and that is already causing a lot of stress. This is another stress that is upon us. And this has been because we have neglected this issue for a long time. Now, these IPCC reports are very critical, and we are unpacking this, and thank you for doing this, because the government, the policy makers need to become more aware and really change. Now, Johor, in the Johor elections, do you think this is featuring?
No.
Is this an important issue? No. It's some of the issues that are taking place, and it's about, of course, the economic recovery is important. But you cannot have economic recovery when your ecology and ecosystem is collapsing. Where all the money in the world, as somebody said, all this wealth in the world, you can't eat money. If you have no food, you're not going to be able to survive. If you don't have water, you have floods, you know, and it's going to be even worse. You can't survive. You can't live. So the time for climate action, it's, many groups have already said, this is a climate emergency. It has to become an election issue. It has to be on the agenda of our MPs and our assemblymen. It has to be on the agenda, not just of our youth, but everyone, including those of us in the middle class particularly. I think we have the luxury, in a way, to understand these things, and we have to amplify these messages so that, you know, there is planetary health. I mean, they talk about planetary health, so that we continue to be able to live on this earth. And I think, if at all, the last final message is, what are we leaving our children? You know, I think this was what is very important. Every mother and every father, you need to ask yourself, what are you leaving your children? And so we have to act. It's agitation and change. I mean, change will only happen if there is agitation. Activism is where it's important. So we would like to see more people join organizations like Sahabat Alam Malaysia and other of the civil society organizations. We need a lot of help in amplifying these messages, and so that we will be able to sustain this, you know, our way of life, and be able to simply live.
Okay. Can't put it better myself, Meena. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Meenakshi Raman. She's the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia. She's the head of programs at the Third World Network. She was helping us to dissect the IPCC's sixth assessment report on impacts, adaptation and vulnerability. If you'd like to support Sahabat Alam Malaysia and also Third World Network, do head to their websites. Sahabat Alam is foe-malaysia.org. And if you'd like to find out more about Third World Network, just head to twn.my. And if you miss any part of today's interview, you can always download the podcast at bfm.my/earth, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.